This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from an ISU expert on state and local government who says the proposal to strip Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner's agenda-setting power might or might not be legal, but it's certainly a bad idea.
You know, Mayor Renner should have the power to add items to the agenda. You know, he represents the whole city and nobody else does.
ISU political scientist Lori Riverstone Newell talks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about city government structure and politics. Education institutions are not alone in expressing a strong dislike of the House version of the GOP tax bill. Find out how healthcare organizations and not-for-profits are also concerned. Ryan Denham reports. And Jim Waldorf from the Sounds of Illinois Chorus talks with Laura Kennedy about the group's annual holiday program. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 4th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some experts in municipal law have raised questions whether the Bloomington City Council move to strip the mayor's power to put items on the agenda is legal. Lori Riverstone Newell is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. She tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker that the first city manager form of government appeared in Virginia in 1908 as part of the urban reform movement. Riverstone Newell says the move toward a city manager form of government was part of a larger progressive movement of the time.
The idea behind that was to have a very, very weak mayor and an empowered council that would be both legislative and political, with a city manager then hired and serving at the pleasure of the council. And so the weak mayor part of that was just to provide a figurehead for the city. And most of the time, the mayor would just be rotated, you know, on an annual basis out of those council members. We had just left a really corrupt period of time in our cities in America where we had machines running our cities and there was very little accountability. There was very little control over cost of service provision. And what we were trying to do in the reform movement was to come up with a way to correct for this too.
And over time, the variations on the theme arose. How did those come to be?
Yeah, the first attempt was that council manager system. And the idea was to not have one strong central figure. And during the machine era, it was the machine boss that was the strong central figure. So if we took the powers of the city and we diluted that across several people, the idea then was that we wouldn't be able to see the level of corruption. They would check one another. And that council manager system worked. It did. It introduced, you know, business style government, and efficiencies followed with lower costs for services and with a more directed agenda. And so that was great. There's a interesting little transition over time where you see the reemergence of strong mayors, though. We got used to the idea of, or maybe we lost our fear of, a strong central figure or authority in the executive position following the Great Depression. FDR came in, and he was seen as someone who really saved the cities, someone who was working directly with cities. And we saw that a strong central government, but also a strong central figure in the executive office could be a good thing. And so around the 1950s, we saw strong mayors coming back into vogue. What's really interesting about that is that, you know, while some strong mayors had survived through the urban reform movement, there's an academic, his name is George Frederickson, and he says that somewhere also around the 1950s, we saw a very slow, quiet adaptation of our city governments where we had corrected for a lot of the inefficiencies and corruption in the early 1900s with that city manager position. But around the 1950s and 60s, we also needed a political figurehead, someone who could unite the city and someone who could bring a cohesive agenda to the table. And that caused us to turn toward bringing in mayors and giving them more power, even in a system that already had a city manager. You know, someone to be able to manage equity issues and to be able to drive economic development in a cohesive and manner. And, you know, people want that. They want the political representation and they want that administrative efficiency at the same time. And that's why we have, on paper, a system that looks very different from what we have in reality. State law only allows for certain types of structure of local governments. You have to pick. And you can pick a strong mayor council style. You can pick a commission style. Only 1% of our cities do that. And you could also pick, you know, a council manager style. And if you have to check one box, then you're going to pick, you know, maybe a council manager style. But in truth, you'll also be electing a mayor. There's a reason for this. This shift happened because we want oversight. We want transparency. We want accountability. We want administrative efficiency. We want all of these things, and you can't find them in these really rigid structures as they are written on paper. So what did we want when we moved more toward a strong mayor style of government, when we started bringing that back in? We wanted someone to speak for all of us. We wanted to make sure that equity was being addressed. And that's really hard to do in a pure ward style or council manager style government, because you're not going to have, one council member may represent a very poor part of town, for instance, or the city, and that's one vote. Who can, if not the mayor, come back in and say, we have to look at this? I think we as a people very smartly began to call upon our governments to do more for us in various ways that aren't reflected necessarily on paper.
In any college public administration class, you're going to get a lesson or a lecture at some point on the dangers of the power of expertise and how staff can run roughshod over elected office holders simply because they have more information and can tailor it. Has there been that sort of excess with city managers from time to time?
Absolutely. Yeah, the idea was that city managers would take care of that political or partisan corruption that we saw in our local governments. And we found very quickly that city managers were also political creatures. And in fact, we've seen some cases, and I love city managers. I'm not trying to knock them off their position, but we've seen some cases where city managers have actually worked to try to get council members or mayors elected, or to try to unseat them from time to time. And obviously, if they're the ones that are asking to add things to council agendas, then they are the ones that have the political pull in a lot of areas of the city functions. And so people go to them.
Well, in the city of Bloomington's case, the proposal is to take the agenda-setting power away from the mayor, mm-hmm. or reduce it, rather, to that of just another council member, mm-hmm. and to have 5 out of the then 9 council members plus the mayor, people sign a petition to put something on the agenda. It had been 4, and then the mayor had a sole agenda-setting power. How does that work usually across the spectrum?
If you have a strong mayor, then that mayor typically has the power to add items to the agenda. Most of our cities that are large in the United States, our larger cities, do have a strong mayor in place, and they typically run the show. In this case, you do have a city manager who should be adding items to the agenda. You do have your council members who, you know, can come together and add items to the agenda. You know, Mayor Renner should have the power to add items to the agenda. You know, he represents the whole city and nobody else does. If that's the case, it seems to me like by taking away that power, we're regressing back to an old ward system, an old ward style government where you have fragmented oversight of your city functions. And, you know, somebody needs to speak for everybody. We have an elected mayor, and we've asked for someone to do that. We elected that mayor to take that role.
What is the structural effect of making the mayor just one of 10 votes rather than having the mayor have that power? Does that elevate the primacy of the city manager's agenda-setting power?
I doubt it. What is being attempted is to actually reduce the power of the mayor's office and to cede that power over to the council members themselves.
If you need five signatures, does it reduce the likelihood that some important issues will be addressed at all because of a political reluctance to do the tough things?
Sure, absolutely. And if you have, let's call them cliques within the council, where there you have just the right number that are taking care of each other, you know, you can reduce the power of the other council members too. There's a real need for someone to be able to say, hey, we really need to look at this. And if you take away the mayor's ability to add items to the agenda, we lose that oversight, that wider vision, if you will. And, you know, on top of that, too, I think it's really important to realize that there's a lot of hostility between, at least traditionally, there's been a lot of hostility between the mayor's office and this council. And this is a political move. This isn't, in my opinion, it's not for the betterment of the council. I've not heard, if Mayor Renner were adding, you know, tons of items to council meetings and, you know, running the agenda off the road, you know, not being able to deal with things that council members, you know, feel like should be dealt with, then that'd be one thing. But that's not what I've heard. You know, I've heard that this is a political move to try to reduce the mayor's power just generally.
The council's been a little reticent in making the case. They've talked about having a more cooperative environment, but they haven't made the case for change.
No, I don't think so. The case that I've heard is that, you know, I think in one case I heard there's a shortage of staff, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense with changing this power of the mayor, but also just that there's a lot that needs to be done and we need to focus. And, you know, that's interesting. If it's true that the mayor is coming in and introducing all sorts of things to the agenda and they're not able to accomplish these goals that or needs that the city has, then that's one thing. I haven't heard that. What I've heard is that you've got, in particular, one alderman, Alderman Sage, who's interested in just, you know, putting the mayor in his seat and has enough support from other council members that may actually be accomplished. I do think it's interesting, though, that the mayor will retain the ability to call special session and to be able to control the agenda in that special session. And so what might happen then is if the mayor doesn't have the ability to modify the agenda or add to the agenda of regular council meetings, that he may be forced then to call extra special sessions to be able to introduce some of these larger citywide goals.
That's kind of a heavy-handed mechanism, though.
They'd be forcing him into it. Or he can choose then to fall in line with what the council wants and serve as just another, you know, council member in many ways. That's not what the public elected. But he could just say, okay, you know, the council's spoken, I'll sit down and I'll just be another voting member. I don't see that happening.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Lori Riverstone Newell, a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University, specializing in state and local government structures. What is the breakdown nationwide of strong mayor versus weak mayor, city manager versus strong mayor forms of government?
Yeah. So what we have is most of your cities now with a population of 50,000 or more have a council manager style government on paper. And most of your cities that are larger or smaller than 50,000, larger by that I mean over a million with population, or smaller than 50,000 people do have a strong mayor style of government.
Why the big ones and the itty-bitty ones having the same and then the mid-sized ones going with city manager? Why did that happen?
I think it has to do with growth. If you've got cities that are smaller than 50,000, the idea of having the efficiencies that are supposed to come with city managers just really isn't on the agenda. They don't need someone that can quickly move the city forward because they're not really growth oriented yet. You know, once you hit around 50,000 people, then things start to change pretty quickly. Either you're going to grow or you're going to regress in your population, and you may then fill the need to put the money toward a city manager, and they're not cheap. In those larger cities, you know, with a million people or more, then what they found is if you have a true council manager system where you don't have a strong mayor in place, then it just gets really complicated and it gets slowed and bogged down because you have various council members representing various areas of the city, and to be able to pull them together and come up with one agenda is just complicated and difficult to accomplish.
This brings up the actual ward structure of the city of Bloomington. A few years ago, then Alderman Rob Fazzini suggested moving to a hybrid system of some elected at large city council members and some ward city council members. The knock on city councils with wards has been that parochial thinking is encouraged and just ward only issues get attention, and the larger strategic issues for the entire city are not as likely to be subject to large scale time investment by council members. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. In some research, what we found is that in some cities, if you have ward-based systems, more of an unreformed political system, then you do have better political representation. And I'm going to put a caveat on that. But the reason why they found that is because having at-large systems oftentimes dilutes the ability of minority groups to be heard. It can be beneficial to minorities because if you do have a ward that's largely minority, they can find representation, find a voice in the system. And it does make sense then to have a few members that are elected at large. I kind of like the hybrid system. I think it's true that the town of Normal is all elected at large. And I think that we could argue that without having a very aware and active council, that there would be some groups whose voices would be swallowed up in that larger city agenda.
Well, speaking from experience, the dissent in the town of Normal is not often. So is there a danger of groupthink when you have everyone at large?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you're thinking at a higher level of abstraction, if you will. You're taking a top-down perspective and looking at the entire city and what's good for all of them without having to necessarily respond to various groups within.
Are there negative trade-offs with a hybrid system?
I don't think so. I think that a hybrid system makes a lot of sense. And I want to relate that back to what's going on with Terry Renner's situation. If you have a hybrid system, then you allow for your voices within those various wards or districts to be heard. And that's a good thing, in my opinion. You want to have somebody close to home to know what you need and to be able to represent you in council. If you couple that with at-large elected members, then you also have this larger oversight, this view that's taking a couple steps up the ladder, and to be able to balance the voices and try to come up with some system of government that looks at individuals and also the needs of the whole city. In the case of Bloomington, what you have is all, you know, ward representation. And if they go back and they remove the power of the mayor to have, you know, to place items on the agenda, then you're really taking away the ability to have that, you know, larger city voice, the cohesive voice that we need to drive city politics as a whole forward. If Bloomington had a few at-large elected members, I would be less negative on what they're trying to accomplish.
Is it even legal to change the mayor's power to set agenda items under the current structure?
I think it is in a very weird way. The way I understand it is that it would not be legal to take away his power to veto. It would not be legal for them to take away his power to call special session. That has to go before a referendum. I think that there's some debate whether or not council has the ability to take away his power to add items to the agenda. But the way that it looks like that the municipal code is written, they may actually be able to accomplish it. Would then Mayor Renner have the ability to come back and take maybe some kind of legal action? I think so. So, I mean, it just depends. It depends on how much he wants to press. And, I mean, he's not
a shrinking violet?
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. He's not a shrinking violet. I don't see him sitting back and just letting this happen. So what does that mean? It means that the council is opening itself up and opening the city up to litigation. Now, come on, you know, is that a proper use of public money? And I would say that there might be other ways to accomplish what they want without taking away the power of the mayor and without opening up the city to some expensive litigation in the future. I think that they need to recognize the law as it stands and the norms across the nation, that being that the mayors have the ability to add items to the agenda. And I think that they need to figure out how to work within that system. You know, this is a political contest, you know. This is a struggle for power and a struggle for some kind of rearrangement of authority within government. And you have to ask yourself why. And barring any good reason, that being that Mayor Renner is trying to take over the whole show and trying to dilute the power of the council somehow, this is something that they need to learn to work within.
And structurally, he can't do that, though.
No. I mean, there's so many checks in the system. And frankly, his ability to add items to the agenda is a check in the system. You know, if you want to dilute the power of the mayor's office, then that has to be, that's not like that power disappears, the power shifts, you know. So who gets the power that's taken away? And that goes directly to the council.
Alderman David Sage, who made the proposal to keep the mayor from placing items on the agenda, has not answered GLT's request for comment. The proposal could return to council attention on December 11th. This is Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, offering mortgage consultation and rates to help you move from renting to owning your home. Additional information available by calling 1-855-891-HOME. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. NMLS ID 139716. This is GLT.
Coming up, a preview of the Sounds of Illinois Chorus Holiday Program. Laura Kennedy has the interview ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Education institutions have expressed a strong dislike of the House version of the GOP tax bill. Now healthcare institutions and not-for-profits are also stressing about it. One of those affected in a big way is Westminster Village, the 501c3 retirement community in Bloomington. GLT's Ryan Denham has more.
Barb Nathan is the CEO of Westminster Village. The House tax bill includes a provision buried in the middle of several hundred pages that would eliminate a class of tax-exempt bonds that not-for-profits commonly use for capital projects, improvement plans, and so on. Westminster is in the middle of a $33 million expansion and renovation. Barb, how much would that provision cost you in extra interest and taxes?
Well, if we had not been able to secure tax-exempt financing for this phase, it would have cost us an additional $5 million in interest over the 10 years of the loan. The bill as it stands today, the wording in it today, says that tax-exempt financing for 501c3 organizations would go away as of January 1st, 2018. In addition, it says that if you're in tax-exempt financing currently, but you haven't drawn all the funds, if you don't draw those funds by January 1st, 2018, they will lose their tax-exempt status after January 1st. So a place like Westminster, who's in the midst of a very large construction project, we've drawn about $10 million of our $30 million in financing currently. You don't want to draw it before you need it, because then you would have to pay interest on it. Well, we're now working with attorneys and bond counsel to determine at one point in the next 30 days, we're going to have to make a decision to draw all those funds. Because out of the chance that this stays in the bill, we could lose the tax-exempt status on $20 million, which would cost us an additional $3.4 million in interest. So it's very scary for the future, but it's also very scary for the here and now, for people that are currently in construction projects like Westminster is.
And tell me about this construction project. I think folks may be aware that you're expanding, but just catch us up.
We are. We are blessed as an organization to be able to take this on as an expansion project. We've been around about 40 years, and a lot of conservative leadership has allowed this to happen. But we are currently adding on to our skilled care. We, of course, are a continuing care retirement community. So in our skilled care, we're adding a two-story building And changing the model that we have from semi-private rooms to private rooms in small neighborhoods to give better person-centered care. We're also moving the entrance of Westminster, the main entrance, to Mercer Avenue, and enlarging all of our common spaces right now. This is actually the first phase of a three-phase project. So the loss of tax-exempt financing for future phases will put the size of those projects, as well as the projects themselves, in jeopardy. But we're moving the entrance, so in the next phase, we can build an assisted living building, including memory care, and then add to our independent living.
If the House GOP tax bill passed as is, I mean, who knows if that'll happen? These things are moving very quickly. The Senate bill does not have this provision in it. But say it were to go through, you said it would be $3.4 million hit for you over the remaining $20 million?
Over the remaining $20 million, and we'll do everything we can to avoid that, which means that before December 31st, and of course, this hasn't even happened yet, so say that we find out on December 15th that this is going to be in the bill. We have to be ready, because we have to take that $20 million today, put it into a project fund, and begin to pay interest on it. Even that would preserve our tax-exempt status of that, but that would cost us about $340,000 in additional interest.
So that's the best-case scenario.
So that's the best. I know. It's kind of strange to say $340,000 is good news, but we, like lots of nonprofits who are in this situation, are getting ready just in case. And if we don't know if it's going to be in or not, we're still going to have to take the money so that we can avoid that potential $3.4 million of additional interest cost over the next 10 years. The Senate bill, you're right, it doesn't include this. I think there's a lot of House representatives that are actually saying, please don't include this. But as we all know, these bills end up having so many different pieces and so many moving parts that it's hard to keep track of everything that's in there. So a number of professional organizations, those representing senior living, universities, hospitals, other nonprofits, are all being very active in talking to the legislators to say, this needs to stay out of these bills.
What's it like for someone like you who's so vested in one of these provisions in a bill that has hundreds of provisions? It is very hard to keep track of how fast this legislation is moving, and there are two versions of it, right?
We actually are a member of Leading Age, which is a large association of senior living providers, really across the continuum. So your low-income housing, all the way through your continuing care retirement communities, nursing homes, et cetera, and all not-for-profits. And so they keep us well informed. They have actually banded together with about 20 agencies that serve seniors, because another way that this tax-exempt financing is used is for low-income housing for seniors. And so they've banded with a number of associations, knowing that there can be great power in that type of collaboration, so to reach out to legislators. I've also reached out, been going to the American Hospital Association site, university sites, et cetera, to try and get the latest news on these. We get alerts almost daily. Our bond council also, for the financing we currently have, sends us updates. You know, it's as if we weren't all busy enough. And it's less than a month ago, we first heard about this. And it's amazing how many hours in a day is now consumed by this. But we're talking about it a lot. We're talking with our board. We're talking with our residents. This is a concern. You know, where is this money going to come from? You know, there's not investors that are giving money to nonprofits and flowing money in. It comes through the operations, and then any that's left at the end of the day goes back into operations. Certainly, you can't put this on the back of residents, et cetera. There's a limit to what can be paid. So the question then you have to look at, okay, what else do we need to scale back? And oftentimes that comes in services in the nonprofits or in reduced number of persons being served in the case of those for lower income, et cetera. So it's a big concern across the board. And again, I'm speaking about senior living. Part of my career was in healthcare. Much of my career was in healthcare. And when I was at the Community Cancer Center, absolutely, it was tax-exempt financing that allowed both the creation of the Community Cancer Center and the expansion. So can you imagine if that had not been there for that organization, the difference that it would have made in terms of the number of people that could be served?
That's an important point. Yeah, this is not something that would just affect Westminster Village on this one project. This is potentially every not-for-profit looking to finance a significant project moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And it was really a surprise to us because of that. I mean, to our knowledge and to our association's knowledge, this has never been talked about before. And so it is a surprise, and yet it has rallied a whole number of people in a whole number of areas to be very aggressive in talking with people. I find that it's actually been a surprise to some of the legislators as well in terms of it. And it doesn't make sense even in terms of the administration's aims that this is about public-private partnership, and we want to stimulate growth. You know, on Westminster's campus right now, there's up to 200 people working on these projects. That's good for our economy. So it's hard to understand, but it is our reality right now. So we're trying to address it and protect Westminster, as well as advocate for removing it or not including it in any tax bill.
Have you done anything to raise these concerns directly with our members of the House? We have Darren LaHood and Rodney Davis in our Bloomington Normal community. Or is that something that you just kind of allow your associations, your trade groups to handle on your behalf?
No, we absolutely do that because that's important. That is who represents us. And in the case of Westminster, that's Rodney Davis. And so I had a discussion with him before the House bill even passed, as did our board members. And I believe a number of our residents have been reaching out. And I know from my conversation with him, he heard from a number of different places. And so it is important we do that advocacy. One of the things our associations do for us is give us very easy ways for residents and patients and others to reach out to them. And so we can easily circulate those emails, et cetera.
What would be your thoughts on a version of this provision that was maybe a delayed rollout so that it didn't impact projects and financing that was already in motion? Like, it seems strange that this affects a project like yours that is like, you know, it's phased out, but, you know, it's already in motion, right?
Mm-hmm. They could do a version that only affected projects in the future, but we would be adamantly opposed to that as well. Mm. As I say, we're in the first phase of an expansion project for Westminster. You know, OSF St. Joseph's just announced an expansion project that I'm sure they haven't gone for financing yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, the impact, again, the impact for $30 million in financing, the increased costs in interest would be $5 million over 10 years. Nonprofits can't afford that. You're going to scale something back or not invest for the future. And there needs to be a balance between the nonprofit world and the for-profit world. You know, we serve this whole community better because of that. But without that opportunity to have that investor money coming in, and also we don't lose money to the investor world, it's really important for us as to fulfill our missions to be able to continue to have this source of funding for capital projects.
That's Barb Nathan, CEO of Westminster Village in Bloomington. I'm Ryan Denham.
Westminster Village is located in Congressman Rodney Davis's district. He didn't respond to a request for comment on his position on the tax-exempt financing provision of the GOP tax bill. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5%
too small. Be thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
It's Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner is getting bad press nationally among Republicans for failing to pass his agenda and for signing a bill to allow abortions under Medicaid and state worker insurance. A lawsuit against that legislation is the subject of this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. Also on the panel, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, and Doug Finke of Gatehouse Media, who lays out the legal arguments in that case.
They're approaching this from two basic points, legal points. One, that the General Assembly did not specifically appropriate any money to pay for the abortions that would be covered by this bill. And the other, without getting too far in the weeds, is that the bill cannot take effect until June 1st. It's supposed to go into effect January 1st, but again, cutting to the chase, they believe the Constitution prohibits it from taking effect before June 1st, and consequently, you couldn't pay for the abortions even if the money was there.
And Democrats see it a lot differently of what this is all about.
They see this as a kind of an equality issue, I guess, for lack of a better term, that if you are wealthy enough under the right circumstances, you can afford to obtain an abortion. Whereas if you're a poor woman or even a woman covered by state employee health insurance, you could not obtain an abortion without paying for it for yourself.
Yeah, and State Senator Heather Staines, who is one of the sponsors of this legislation, told me that, you know, the people behind this lawsuit lost in the legislature when it came up for a vote. They lost in trying to persuade the governor to veto it. And she said that, you know, this is trying to continue the what's a political fight that they lost in the courts. As Doug did a good job explaining those issues, it's very kind of arcane. Me, as a former Law Bulletin reporter, I kind of enjoy these debates. You know, there's an attorney general opinion about, you know, whether the effective date of a law is when you actually cast the votes, when they press, you know, physically press the red and green buttons on the legislature, or when the actual, you know, paperwork gets filed to say that it's passed both houses. And, you know, this is something that Peter Breen, state representative, says, you know, has not actually been addressed by the courts. There is this attorney general's opinion out there, but he's eager to see it happen. But in terms of his budgetary argument, I mean, this is something you could make for any law that passes after a budget is implemented, right? That they didn't specifically do a line item for it. And if you think of abortion as a medical procedure, it's not as though the state budget has line items for every different type of medical procedure you could have for, you know, people on the Medicaid program or people under state employee health care, be it open heart surgery or giving birth or something like that. So, I mean, obviously, for people who oppose abortion, they feel very strongly about it. And you can understand, you know, that they would want to use every tool legally at their disposal to try and fight it. But this is, you know, something that we'll have to see how the courts react to this.
And Charlie, you've followed budgeting in the state of Illinois for decades now. What is your thought on these arguments?
Well, I agree with Brian. The notion that there was not specifically money set aside, one could argue that the Medicaid program never has money set aside, as Brian pointed out, specifically for this, that, or the other thing. But because it is an entitlement program, whatever is covered statutorily within the bounds of these are the services we provide, they get provided regardless, even if there's not enough money, and even if it's clear that there's not enough money. Medicaid services were provided all the while we didn't have a budget. So I think that's an argument that if I had to argue against the legislation, I would raise that too. I don't think it's going to prevail. And on the other, the more arcane thing, one of the things you have to remember, or I don't know if this is maybe too much in the weeds for, you know, the average person who doesn't follow this stuff obsessively like, say, I do. Every piece of legislation that clears both chambers of the General Assembly, the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House literally sign on that piece of paper, that legislation, affirming that this particular bill has met all the constitutional requirements. And while there's not a case relating directly to whether or not this, the timing of a bill that had a hold put on it after it passed with the proper majorities in both chambers, which is the argument that Representative Breen and others are making, kind of a historical precedent is if you go back to the White Sox legislation that created or that kept the White Sox in Chicago, that bill passed in everybody's estimation after a deadline that would have required additional votes. But the person who was in the chair of the House at the time, Representative Jim McPike of Alton, declared after he said this bill has passed and the time is now 11:59. Everybody else thought it was 12:03 into the next fiscal year, which would have required a supermajority, which wasn't there. The Supreme Court said, well, whatever the person in the chair says, that's the official time. So they deferred there in a situation that was a lot clearer, you would think, that, yes, this did not meet one of these requirements. They deferred to what the legislature said.
Charlie Wheeler is with the University of Illinois at Springfield. Brian Mackey is a State House reporter for IPR. And Doug Finke works for Gatehouse Media. IPR's Sean Crawford moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Opponents of the Medicaid abortion law say there are 15 states that have public funding of abortion decided by the courts. But Illinois is the first in a very long time to do so legislatively. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. A venerable Twin Cities a cappella singing group have a holiday double whammy for the community. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The Sound of Illinois Chorus has recorded a Christmas CD, and its release coincides with their upcoming holiday concert, which is Sunday, December 10th at 3 p.m. in the sanctuary of Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. Admission is free. Jim Waldorf is a longtime member of the 80-man chorus, whose new CD is entitled This is Christmas.
We decided last year in honor of our 75th anniversary that we wanted to do something. And we had been singing on the State Farm Sounds of Christmas program since its inception some 29, 30 years ago. So we just went through and picked out the best of the songs that we had sung over those years and decided why not compile them and see if we could record a new CD with it.
Well, you know, the State Farm Sound of Christmas concert is no more. So do you perhaps feel that your concert coming up on the 10th might fill a gap in the market, as they say?
That's certainly our plan. We started, the Sounds of Christmas was supposed to be on December 10th. And when we heard that it was postponed due to the remodeling of the atrium initially, we said, well, why don't we do a Christmas concert that night? And then we found out several weeks later that it's been canceled completely, which is unfortunate, but that's the way things are. So we talked to Second Press, and they said they would just love to have a Christmas concert in the building. And we said, we think we can help you out.
Tell me about the acoustics in Second Press.
Singing in that room is just absolutely fantastic. The acoustics are perfect. They do have a sound system, but I don't think we even use it when we sing in the sanctuary portion of the church.
Well, Jim, you have a selection of your on your album, This is Christmas.
Right.
Why is it This is Christmas?
Well, it's taken from the line in What Child Is This? This is Christ. At the end of the highlight of the song, it's the high point of the song. And we thought that that would make an excellent title.
This is Christ the King, whom shepherds guard and angels sing. Haste to bring him love, the babe, the
have a nice selection here of old and new songs. I mean, you going back to O Come, Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. But you also have A Chipmunk Christmas on here.
I'm a boomer. I don't know. And, you know, the chipmunks were a big part of Christmas. And, you know, I still want my hula hoop.
Me, I want a hula hoop. We can hardly stand the wait. Please, Christmas,
tell me about the selection process. These are songs that you have learned to do over the years. Now, is it a democratic process, voting on what songs you will or won't do? How does that come about?
You know, it's really interesting. We have a music committee that makes our song selections, and they are obviously talented and trained musicians, formally trained musicians. I am not a trained musician, so I'm glad to have them helping with the decision-making process. But it's really a matter of gathering up the songs that the guys felt the most impact from. And Mary Did You Know is a perfect example and one of my favorites on the CD.
Why is that?
Well, it's just such a striking song.
Mary, did you know?
Christmas. It's just amazing. We hadn't sung that song for 2 years, 3 years maybe. For a while, we did it every year on the Sounds of Christmas, and it was really funny because other people would say, other acts in the show would say, we want to sing Mary, Did You Know? And they'd say, well, Sound of Illinois is already doing
that. You had
already
dibs.
Doing that. We had dibs. So anyway, we hadn't done it for a couple of years and hadn't even looked at it, and we took it out for the first night of rehearsal and sang through it, and Terry Ludwig, our director, said, well, we don't have to work on that anymore. You guys, it's obvious how much you care for that song. So we knew that that was going to be an important part of the CD. And the rest of the songs are, again, just a mixture of good old holiday standards and things that we had fun with and wanted to do again, just like Alvin in the Chipmunk Christmas song.
Well, you also have The Little Drummer Boy on here, and that, I think, is a song that really showcases the range of voices well in the group.
That's an interesting arrangement of Little Drummer Boy. There are parts in it where it actually goes into seven parts, which is definitely not barbershop, but just a fantastic arrangement that we had to tackle. And so again, that, you know, songs we like, songs that we find challenging, certainly songs about the season, and songs are fun, that are fun. So that's where we came up with the list.
Do you do your own arranging?
We have. I don't know if we've got anything on this album that was arranged by one of our members. I can't remember. But we also use a stable of society arrangements in the Barbershop Harmony Society. David Wright, I believe, arranged the first song on the CD, Caroling, Caroling. And he's a member of the Ambassadors of Harmony down in the St. Louis area. He's done a lot of arranging for us.
Where did you record this CD?
Actually, we recorded it here at ISU.
Oh, great.
In the Center for Performing Arts. Another wonderful...
Yeah, the CPA there has great acoustics.
Another great room to sing in.
Well, now, I understand that this CD is already selling pretty briskly.
Yeah, our initial order sold out almost immediately, or is very nearly sold out, but we'll have plenty more coming in next week so that we can fill orders. We do plan to have it at the concert.
Great.
At Second Presbyterian, so our fans can pick up a copy.
And they can have Christmas year-round.
That's right. From the Sound of Illinois to your home.
That's Jim Waldorf from the Sound of Illinois Chorus. Their concert is Sunday, December 10th at 3 p.m. at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and at WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Charlie Schlenker, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org, or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News.
Sing we all this happy morn, lo, the King of Heaven is born. Ding dong, ding dong, merrily now we carol along. Ding dong, ding dong, Christmas bells.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Can't you hear the joyful sound?